Vladimir and I were talking about it. So this time, one inference that came that through these experiments and this through these studies, in other words, that we are probably locating one thing, that mind has a tendency to, when first look at the source, then divide it, and then cut off the source, and then study the divided things, and then try to rediscover the source. And as if that's the only way we can validate, yes, the source exists. So, it's an impulsion, I think, given to mind as its origin. Mm-hmm. Fixing its point of reference at one point and considering the other point as not self.
What she's saying, the mind itself is already a context into which being has its own input. And it takes it already in this bubble approach and cannot take it out of it. So that's why this part inside, you see the way it's also a context of some force in the particular context in the water. And this is the particular context of light in these two slits into which light is projected. The same context. I mean, the way you see uninterrupted time factors, as if one after the other it moves. The photons, you don't see this. Maybe this is an impulse. Or maybe it's a minimal time. Or maybe it's not even time. Maybe it's just a context into which the being or consciousness is projected as mind. It splits it in it. It's quite interesting that the mind behaves in the same manner as physics, or as any context behaves. So in a way it proves that the mind does that ish.
Yeah, Aristotle describes that. He says if you look at a point, and if the point has color, then mentally you register the point and the color. And in reality, there is a point, and it does have color. And so there are four. There are two doubles which occur in the moment of perception. And the mind knows that it is a double of the double.
Meaning four means, one is no color and another is color,
One is a point and one aspect of the point is its color.
Yeah.
So there's the substance and the form.
Yeah.
And in the mind, both are reflected.
Achha.
So the consciousness of the two and the two
realities
that are the object are one perception, one content, one mental content, which is a very complex series. And so there are a lot of German philosophers have taken that, Hegel and Heidegger and so on, this idea that mind is a double, and it may be When it describes it, it is doubling it again, and then that doubling becomes an object of the first doubling, and so there's this recurrence of patterns, repetition and recurrence, that we then think of as the reality itself, and actually it is a mental phenomenon that we're constantly interpreting from that basic trace.
Because actually, what I read from what you're saying is that the linking mechanism of mind is that it links between substance and the phenomenon, and also it links between the phenomenon to come up with a property of the substance.
Yeah, that's the analysis part.
Yeah, I mean, like,
it creates
creation. I mean, I don't know. Human mind actually cannot create phenomena.
Human mind is only part.
It's universal mind. anyway, we'll come to that. So now we jump to totally a different sector of physics, that is symmetry and asymmetry of nature. Again, attacking Einstein, by the way, like this is going to attack the relativity. The other one was attacking the mechanical division as an absolute thing, and here it is relativity, symmetry that is suggested by relativity. So C stands for charge, P stands for parity, and T stands for time reversal. So what it really means, we are all familiar with matter and antimatter. This is nothing but say electrons, antimatter is positron, meaning positive electrons. So if the charge is the opposite, so we call the corresponding particle as the antimatter. So basically, C symmetry is what it is saying, is that if all the matter are converted into its antimatter, and all the antimatter at this time are converted into matter, meaning exactly the mirror image of this matter-antimatter distribution at this time, the whole universe will follow the exact physical laws as it is today. So this is called C symmetry. P symmetry is parity. Parity is what actually, at this time I would like to show this image. See, this is a point mirror. The yellow, the colors are shown just to show different images. It's actually the same thing, same object. So the green and the yellow is the reflection of the green, and the red is the reflection of the yellow. So what it is that the mirror that we are used to is a two-dimensional mirror. So it actually sort of makes two of the three dimensions as opposite. We don't really, but here the mirror, as it is like a single point, so basically we see all three dimensions as opposite. So what it is, parity, okay, now we go back, this is just to show the so this parity is, so what it is saying is that if all the objects are reflected opposite by just like that point reflector, then the whole universe will follow the exact same physical law. That means all the things that we are seeing or whatever are there are exactly specially reversed. And another is T symmetry, time reversal, which is basically traveling backward in time. This is my line, it's the hardest to comprehend. But it's saying that if we go backward in time, all the laws will be followed. The universe will flow the same way as it is today. So these are called three symmetries. Yes?
Yeah, it's not interesting that symmetries, there's a mental change, leaving the time factor, the space factor, three dimensions.
And the force factor, charge. Charge is nothing but force, right? So, you're right, like force, space, and time.
And nothing more to create. What else we can reflect? Mirror.
So, anyway, we are in the mode of physics right now. So it said that CP, first of all, the charge symmetry has been violated by weak forces. Weak force is nothing but the radioactive forces, where the neutrons are converted into protons and electrons. Like if neutron is as if like a proton of the same mass but a positive charge, and an electron of the opposite charge but with almost no mass, so altogether neutron. So. But then some force, some kind of force particle emits from it, and also many other things like neutrino and all that. But anyway, let's not get into that. This weak force is that radioactive decay. Okay. So there it is shown that this matter antimatter symmetry and the parity symmetry, given their combination, first of all their individual symmetry is violated, and also the combination, because they are decaying into a direction which is not following the symmetry, this C symmetry and P symmetry, and also their combination is also violated. Now, when their combination is violated, automatically it infers the violation of T symmetry also, because relativity suggests that these three, combination of these three, if they are reversed, meaning all matter are reversed as if it's antimatter. Mind you, it's not just electron is being reversed to positron, but also positrons are being reversed to electron. Both. Say we have three electrons and two positrons. So the two positrons will become two electrons, and three electrons will become three positrons. So the other side of the reverse is going to have three positrons, two electrons, instead of three electrons, two positrons. So that's the way. So basically, this combination of like all the matter is exactly transferred to its the antimatter counterpart, and partially specially reflected in all its three dimensions by just like point reflector, and moving event-wise moving from one point of time to another point of time in the backward direction compared to what we have. So if these three combinations are taken, they absolutely are invariant, meaning they cannot be broken. So what ultimately boils down to, I'm giving, instead of going into the detail, that as if the space and time together, because charge is cannot be there without space and time. So space and time together, if we look at the universe, it is uniform in all directions. So that's what it actually says. All CPT, okay, that is suggested by relativity. Till this time, we are assuming the CPT is invariant. So CP violation will automatically mean T violation, because the combination of these three is invariant. Okay. Now T violation, we have already seen macroscopic violation, though microscopic violation you cannot really say. The second law of thermodynamics, you know about entropy, which goes only in one direction, like entropy never decreases, it always increases. Entropy is basically disorderliness. Let us not get into that detail. Another thing is the dynamic law, thermodynamics, that is the as a dynamic law of nature. Another is the black holes. Due to the initial condition of our universe, black hole is also violating T, because when you move far in the forward direction of light, it is swallowed by black hole. Whereas in the backward direction, you cannot think like that. It is almost like sinking and being generated kind of thing. So it is not really that way symmetrical. So that is another violation of T violation. This I just want to mention. So CPT symmetry is what we are really interested in. The implication of CPT symmetry is that a mirror image of our universe, with all objects having their positions reflected by an imaginary 3D point reflector, all momenta reversed, which is basically implying the time reversal, and with all matter replaced by antimatter, corresponding to a charge inversion, would evolve under exactly our physical laws. Meaning the evolution will continue to be the same. Then basically evolution as if is an illusion and nothing else. Anyway, the CPT transformation turns our universe into its mirror image and vice versa. CPT symmetry is recognized to be a fundamental property of physical laws. In order to preserve this symmetry, every violation of the combined symmetry of two as its component must have a corresponding violation in the third component, as I just mentioned. In fact, mathematically, these are the same thing. Thus, violations in T-symmetry are often referred as to as a CP violation. So, it's just to from your information. Okay, now here it's actually the main focus, CPD violation. Relativity violation in scales below nanometer. So, this violation is detected at a very minute scale. Space-time is not uniform in all directions. Space-time has its inherent direction. At least that's how it has been mentioned. Sometimes referred to as relativity violation vector, meaning the direction, basically every direction can be presented as a vector. And it's named as relativity violation since this very presence of this vector is violating the special theory of relativity. It is actually, see, the whole this time dilation, all the phenomena that are explained by relativity is actually has an inherent assumption. Just like Bohr's thing had an inherent assumption that there is a single observer, just like that, in relativity, there is an inherent assumption that things are uniform when space and time are taken together in this whole universe.
So if there are such violation factors, then that means that we cannot predict actually what will happen with this or that violation.
Right. So basically all kinds of variations, meaning inconsistency, like some reference frame is showing a slower clock and some, all these things are happening due to our fixity with one reference frame, but the thing is taken two together, it takes place, that sort of thing. So that means two together means if the whole universe is taken together, there is no non-uniformity or something to be shocked about. Everything is perfectly uniform. That's how Einstein has seen the universe.
What do you mean when you say things are uniform?
Uniform means if...
related to light.
Yeah.
That means this is the uniform of thing by which you can measure everything.
Right.
And the space and time is fixed by that. That basically becomes violate that.
Yeah.
There are factors of violation. Which means that they know that if it moves in the direction we suppose it should be, then there will be all kinds of things in space. The space can be twisted, turned on itself, and there can be knots of space and then not. So there is, that's what I understand by the vector violation. Because otherwise what it would mean? What is this vector? It's a direction of space or time or
a whole universe. Very right. I mean, I'm now talking about in a more physical or materialistic way, which you are saying is actually reflected by the material properties, or rather by theory of relativity, is that when we are seeing a direction, as if say you are, direction is, as he is saying, that speed, like movement of light, our basic sense of direction is coming from visualization first, right? So basically this direction, even if you come from slower to faster or whatever, this kind of different reference frame that makes us feel that things are incomprehensible, like for example something out there in a different planet is behaving in a certain way, but we are seeing it in a different way. But Einstein is saying it is our error of perception because we cannot see the whole universe as one thing because we follow a particular direction of our observation, but that is not real direction, it is our observational direction. So what he is denying is that there is no real direction. It is the between the observations we have direction.
But the observer, by being present in the observation, also has an effect that was proven on the thing that is happening.
Yeah.
So the moment the observer comes into the thing, the thing continuously changes, influenced by the forces the observer puts on this thing. So this gives another dimension of change inside the thing which is not foreseeable at all.
Yeah, but here they're not going that far. I mean, they're not really seeing the observer perception, anything to do with any kind of force which is coming out of perception and all that. And it is very materially speaking that, like observation is something to do with our error of this fixity with the reference frame. And the thing that we are observing, if we are observing from a different reference frame, it is different. So basically what he is saying that if you correct or take the theory of relativity and correct your mathematical equation, you will see things are exactly different. I mean, I don't know, then I will have to, after this, then we'll have to get into mathematics.
Let me see, one experiment was done by Emoto. He was showing the patterns of water crystals under certain circumstances. Mm-hmm. But then in the laboratory it came out that at the moment a person is approaching this crystal and with his energy the crystal itself changes only by the presence of the observer. So the pattern after being observed is not the same and it was before. So the observer has a physical force on the object, which changes the consistency.
Yeah, I think I understood that, but it's just that relativity is not concerned with that. It is only concerned with the actual material facts. It is not taking into consideration that the force is coming from our observation itself.
Because the observer is already the best part of the particular visiting of the time. So because of that, we have an assumption that observer influences the quantum. Are you sure that the quantum
Because
you can make a typical pattern with the same observer all the time. So when I come to that water, the pattern will change this way. When you come to the water, the pattern will change this way. So that's how they found out that it depends on the observer who's looking at it.
But
and on the same observer, it's almost always the same. But if the observer changes, the change of the matter will be different from the
Usually it's observer, maybe it's a context. But the context has changed.
Take photographs from it.
Framework, and that's why it takes this context.
Maybe Einstein will say there's an error in perception. Both observations are errors. We might say but what we are really pointing towards that, exactly what he said, is that relativity also has an inherent assumption that as if light speed is infinite. See, that's why it has to first establish the fact that nothing moves faster than it.
Needs some constant.
Exactly, and that's limit. Some kind of.
That's what you mean by uniformity.
Yeah.
The speed of light doesn't change.
Exactly. And nothing moves faster than light. That's why it is the errors between perceptions, not an absolute error.
And when we live in space of time and space, when we leave the concept of time and space,
then we have to make another presentation. Okay, sorry, I mean, I love to get into this kind of discussion, but I am limited by my physics at this time. So, okay, so even light, okay, this goes even further. Even light could be nothing but the oscillations of these background vectors. Anyway, this is just a statement, I don't want to further analyze right now. Okay, so this is how, this is probably the main motivation factor for me to even present this. And also, Vladimir, actually, when I talked about this particular thing, he said that he should present it. So this is my presentation in the entire meeting. I thought that mechanical or relativistic, see, mechanical is the Newtonian and relativistic is a clarified mechanical in the context of the whole universe, not just the Earth planet. So this mechanical relativistic universe, here if we draw a graph of a particle, see, it's also this mechanical universe is seeing the whole universe as a huge space where the body of the substance of the universe, which are nothing but particles or aggregation of particles, which are moving from one point of space to another point of space in course of time. So this is like a point presentation of the actual whole universe in space and time. So this is Einstein's view or mechanical relativistic universe view. And this is how I felt that quantum is suggesting, though it is not really stating in these very words, but maybe it's my perception clarified by Aurobindo. I came to this, that this is actually, say, whole universe, you think. This whole universe is moving from one point of time to another point of time in course of evolution. So why I'm saying it, that it has something to do with the quantum explanation, is because it suggests that as if the measurement is actually moving from one point to another. Is it like this whole universe is measured at this point of time and then is measured in this way at that point of time? So if I relate that measurement as a perception, and the perception, movement of perception in time as evolution, that's how I have drawn this picture.
Basically, the first graph is about as if we look from within, from inside into the cosmos. We see the movement of all these particles and bits of ourselves in time. And we think the space is exactly objectively existing thing in which we move. But here we see space outside, so to say. The space is not, it's a body of the universe which changes every time in the course of evolution. This is what it is.
So basically it is not, see, this is like a holistic view, I would say, right? Like space-time wise, the whole space is connected. All perceptions are connected. That's why we get laws. They're not disconnected. So, and I put the famous statement of Aurobindo, time and space are that one conscious being viewing itself in extension, subjectively as time, objectively as space.
That's why we have this double phenomena. We have subjective, objective view of the thing. So everything will be double view. That's why mind works like this.
So now we hear some crazy stuff. I don't want to get into the detail because then we'll need days. John Miller, he is saying, does quantum theory suggest that what the observer will do in the future defines what happens in the past? What he is saying, that since Niels Bohr has said that when one measurement of one photon was made, then the consecutive photons spin was determined, whereas Einstein was saying both spins were already there. When one is measured, the other is known. This is the difference. Now John Miller is saying that means that if Bohr is correct, then the measurement is determining what. So he is basically confusing with the two. He is taking Einstein's perception of is actually that spin was already there, which is the past, measurement defined that past. So that's what I would say is the confusion. I will come to that later. This is a balance. It's quite interesting. Quantum information loss versus black hole information loss, suggested by Roger Penrose, is a very famous scientist. He wrote, actually I read his things in a huge book, Road to Reality. I didn't read the whole book, but this thing caught my attention. This balance between the probabilistic information loss is that when we see a photon striking, say we don't really see photon striking, but conceptually we think of bands as coming out of photon striking the screen, right? The very first experiment I was in. So when we see photon striking the screen, we don't know which slit it came through, right? So that means it has two potential routes, which is not determinable. Like it's uncertain which route it takes. So basically when we see the photon's point, striking point on the screen, we lose the information of the past. Meaning the past means the past we lose by seeing the future. And black hole information loss is like when the light is moving, when we are going in the future, then also we are losing the information because the light that contained all the information about the stuff that was carried in it is swallowed by black hole. So that is in the forward direction of light. The quantum information loss is like almost like an abstract information loss because we are looking at the future and we don't know which source it came from. And actually it has some kind of thought experiment. If we have extra time, I can describe that later. Which is showing two potential sources of light coming to the same point and which where there is no way to determine which source it came from. So Roger Penrose is suggesting that these two information laws are somehow balanced in the whole universe. It's just a postulate or hypothesis, which you were using. And another crazy stuff is that then light could be nothing but the oscillations of the unknown vectors. On this page, whatever it is there is very has. There's no real proof, even materialistically. These are all hypothetical things. Okay. Hawking radiation, evaporating black hole and white hole, vacuum fluctuation. Vacuum fluctuation is something that I can little bit describe, so which will also tell you Hawking radiation and white hole. Is that there is a notion of virtual particle. What the virtual particles are, that we already talked about matter and antimatter. So say electron, positron, or and proton, antiproton, and all that stuff. So basically, what it is suggesting is that this matter and antimatter, they're being converted into each other, meaning electron is becoming positron, immediately positron is becoming back electron. So this kind of fluctuation is happening so fast that neither can we detect the electron, nor can we detect the positron. Because they're changing their states too fast. Because, mind you, all to be visible or to be detectable, it has to have a particular electromagnetic property. Because light itself is an electromagnetic wave. So if their state of charge is undeterminable or too much fluctuating so fast that is not, if there is no gap, almost no gap, so then they become virtual. It is not possible to detect. So then Hawking is saying that these strange particles, when they come near the black hole horizon, event horizon, somehow if one gets trapped into the black hole, the other becomes real. Right? Because the other has, the one, its partner has gone. So it cannot convert back and forth anymore. So, what happens when it becomes real? It becomes a particle. So, what it really seems is that as if the black hole is emitting particles. Actually, the actual fact is that there were actually virtual particles twin which came near the event horizon of the black hole. So, not only that, it's another thing is that when that particle, that which was trapped into the event horizon of the black hole, has negative energy because it got trapped. So, because of the negative energy, black hole is now losing its energy, which is nothing but losing its mass. Gravitational energy, that's all it is characterized by. So, it may seem like black hole is losing its mass, evaporating and emitting particles. So, that is how we got this. This is called Hawking radiation.
Creating singles.
So, the black hole fluctuation is that matter-antimatter thing. And when it gets trapped, then we see this phenomenon of evaporating black hole. And it's also called white hole because it generates instead of solid. And actually, black hole and white hole are the same object. That there is proofs of that also. Anyway, everything is hypothetical anyway. So the Hawking is really crazy.
Can we draw a consequence out of this that the what we call matter exists only at a very short instance, and before and after there are only probabilities? And only in a very short moment what we call reality or matter happens, and what happens before and what happens after is our probability of matter, but not matter as a reason.
Which point it becomes real? Like, how do you differentiate that point? I'm not trying to understand that phenomenon that
you're talking about. There's a moment where we have an impression of something real, of something matter, of something constant.
We have.
Yeah, we have.
So it
observers.
Has to do with the observation, not the matter itself.
Well, Whitehead spent a lot of energy trying to define that paradigm too. He calls it potential and actual. And every moment is an actualization of a potential which lies in the future, actually. And that future potential he calls the real, and this actual moment he calls presence. And so everything that happens in time, in perceptible time, is a concrescence, a concretization of the relationship between the actual and the potential. So that potential would be the black hole, the other side of time, which contains everything that was and everything that will be, but only in a potential or probabilistic way. Have you read Whitehead?
No.
So it would be interesting probably to see how this translates into philosophy. Because he was participating with these guys and their speculation.
So it is basically a philosophical interpretation. And dark matter, we all know. That matter which has some kind of gravitational influence, other than that we cannot really, it is proved that there is something that we don't know, we don't see. I'm not literally making it in the context of dark matter. So, it's quite an experience explaining physics to a philosopher. So, I mean, because myself, I feel like I agree with everyone, but I have to hold this physics stick. Yeah. So this WIMPs, weakly interacting massive particles, Meckel's massive astrophysical compact hollow objects, virtual particles, which I already said, trans-Planckian problem, which is something that the particle emitted by black hole, which I just described here, it traced back to horizon, must have at an infinite frequency. It's just again this kind of paradoxical view of in the event horizon of the black hole, because in a way everything is zero and or infinite. Either way, depends on how you describe.
So what is dark matter?
Nothing. I mean, we don't know. That is, it's still dark.
That's why it's dark.
It's still dark.
But they say that 80% of the universe is this dark matter where we don't see any light.
80%? I don't remember the number, but I don't know if it's that much.
At least I heard it from the microversion model session. Yeah. Mm-hmm. 80% is dark matter. It's a little bit too much. No?
Mm. It's the void.
So anyway, so basically these WIMPs and MECOs and all these things are effort to explain dark matter. If nobody is interested, I would rather not get into the details.
You know, there's an explanation for the percentage. If you can imagine that all the future and the past are there, and in the present there's only a fraction of that. So 80 is maybe even conservative estimate.
And it's even more because we see light, we don't see
the dark. 80 is interesting. Okay. So, interesting insights. These are from people in science area itself. So the common sense idea that there is an objective reality out there all the time is a fallacy. When reality and knowledge are entangled, question of when something becomes real, that actualization, cannot be answered in a straightforward manner. This is Paul Davis, he was a great physicist, and he wrote it in his book About Time.
But Penrose is also preoccupied with that question. And he calls that moment the quantum reduction, when the quantum is reduced to a real moment. Mm-hmm. But then he asks the question, how does it happen that we have these apparently continuous real moments?
Mm-hmm. So he projects that question, but somehow, I don't know, through his writing, that sort of tendency towards feeling that it is mind which creates reality somehow could be seen.
Yeah, but then he's asking, what is the force? That reality that the mind perceives and this quantum
reduction.
This quantum indeterminism. But somehow there is a continuum of reality that we perceive.
That's why he was looking for that balance. Remember we were talking about, right? Just describe that quantum information loss and background information loss in two opposite directions of time. That's what he was looking for, and ultimately right now he stands there, but he's still hoping that he will be able to prove this balance in the universe so that this continuum takes place. Anyway, I have a lot of disagreement with he has a certain interpretation which is his interpretation. So, relationship between mind and matter. This is this person has really clarified, in my opinion, a lot, unlike many others. David Bohm, a little bit history about David Bohm, in case you don't know, is that he was a PhD student when the atom bomb was being created in America. He was able to solve something that Oppenheimer group couldn't solve. So, but he was supposed to be somehow linked with Communist Party. So his whole work, career, everything was really victimized by the government, American government. But he was really sharp, and his paper was even liked by Einstein himself. Einstein himself called him as his own successor. Very brilliant. However, he actually challenged Einstein and supported Bohr more later. So he has a lot of metaphysical conclusions, which is metaphysical, but he established it even with mathematical equations. The relationship between mind and matter, without reducing one to nothing, but a functional aspect of the other. Is what his article, actually I cut off that part, is what his article was about. This relationship between mind and matter. So he is also saying such reduction commonly takes the forms, reduction meaning mind to nothing, matter as everything, is the materialism. And mind is an epiphenomenon having no real effect on matter. And the other extreme is of idealism, which reduces matter to some kind of thought. For example, in the mind of God. And that's how he describes it. I just picked it up. Basically, it is about an article about mind and matter relationship. So another is the essential feature, the same article has it. The essential feature of this idea, the notion of the enfolded or implicate order. Meaning he comes with this implicate order. Okay, what implicate order he really refers to as in quantum theory is that inherent property that we were kept talking about, that the being unpolarized is a property of each photon and not an aggregation of two different opposite photons. And which rate it will take. This kind of thing he referred to as implicate order. Meaning it is not a playing a dice, but it is actually something implicated, an order that is implicated in the individual particles. So this kind of implicate order. And the essential feature of this idea was that the whole universe is in some way enfolded in everything, and that each thing is enfolded in the whole.
That's an implication.
Yeah, of course. I mean, just try to, as I said very initially, like I'm trying to put different people's thoughts.
An implication is a mental phenomenon. There is nothing that is implied except in the mind.
Yeah, but the thing
but
is,
this is
depends
the
on
reality, isn't it?
Yeah, but depends.
This is the question. What he puts here, two things that you cannot take matter as such.
No, no, the question is order implied, or is order really order?
But the mind is creating this order, creating this manifestation out of something which is there. So it is a part of reality.
Right. No, what he is saying, I wanted to say something. What he is saying is that these two orders explicate what we are seeing, that what Einstein also saw and even named it as God, this order. That is explicate. An implicate order is something that is inherently taking care of that. So these two are interacting. One cannot exist by itself. Like, that's what he is saying.
The very thing that light is traveling somewhere and projected in something already implies these two. You can't really avoid them. There is a context, there is somewhere something which is out of its own place, which has duration, which has an action onto something else. And because that something else is there, then the two properties immediately emerge. So original movement towards some non-original manifestation of some kind. How they were generated, these movements, why they are there. So there must be something of the kind which implies two.
Right. So basically an implication in the mind doesn't necessarily mean that it does not exist.
Philosophically speaking.
So, David Bohm further goes in the same article saying Niels Bohr has made a very subtle analysis. Then he goes on, but anyway, he treats the entire process of observation as a single phenomenon, which is a whole that is not further analyzable. For Bohr, this implies that the mathematics of the quantum theory is not capable of providing an unambiguous, that is precisely definable, description of an individual quantum process, but rather that it is only an algorithm yielding statistical predictions concerning the possible results of an ensemble of experiments. So I really like this, and I agree with that. This is because many people are misinterpreting Bohr because he didn't bother to explain his theory of correspondence, which is mind-boggling. Anyway, so implicate or again David Bohm, the implicate order is not static, but basically dynamic in nature. It is in a constant process of change and development. Now, here Niels Bohr's statement comes: physics should be limited to the description of the correlations between perceptions.
No speculation
about why. No, it's like just physics is incapable. That's what.
There's no such thing as physics. Okay. Something beyond perception.
Right. So let's take a look. These are the questions with whatever my limited Maya I put on. God does not play dice. Why not? What compels us to think that God is an artist and not a player? So, this is the question. And
why can't a player be an artist?
Yeah, no, I'm not saying that gambling not artist. An artist. I'm saying why to think it's only an artist and not a player. That's what I mean. Because artist is something that Einstein always perceived.
The very funny thing about this is that in Sanskrit we have this word deity. Deity is to shine, to be a day of a light, yellow, heaven, shining. All from these words. Deity has two meanings. One is to shine, another is to play dice. Playing dice. So to say playing, play of light. It's play of light, playing dice.
So the next, Carl Sagan, is absence of evidence is not evidence of absence. And then, this is totally, I already referred. The quantum theory suggests what we will do in future defines what happens in the past. My question is, are we missing the fact that we did measurements in the past too? So in studies, don't we compare between past and future measurements? So next is, this was a question by John Wheeler, remember, there was an earlier slide. And then next is having two observers measuring twin photons movement. Making them incoherent, like two independent observers are observing. It was when Copenhagen said. Then this somebody came with a question that, well, one measurement was made, then they determines the other. How about the two different observers made the measurement? So I'm saying having two observers measuring twin photons movement is abstract. We are trying to prove matter's incapacity to present the property of coherence to some dream characters who are also incoherent observers. So, another thing is, we assume that if we divide a fragment matter, it will become simpler, but does it? And then this, what Rod was talking about, what is the real difference between information potentially active and actually active? So, these are the like food for thought, are we equating the word actuality as becoming? Remember that becomes real? As if that actually active is the becoming, which we are naming as being actually active. Potentially active, we are not naming as actual, because it does not become, or has not become. So, are they equating the word actuality as becoming? Is this why time is something we cannot go behind? Because we follow the actuality by its becoming. We cannot go behind, psychologically. Because becoming is driven by, as if like there is a driver time standing with a gun. You go and become. As if time is the driver. So we cannot drive time, time drives us.
But when time starts and when it stops, that's the next question.
Yeah. But at this time, we are limited by that. So, and also like, you know, Einstein said, reality is merely an illusion and all that stuff. Like, basically they're seeing that we are trapped into some kind of becoming into one another. You know, that's all, what we perceive is actuality, but if we really investigate further, it becomes an illusion. 5 minutes? Okay. So, I think I'm almost done. So, yeah.
No, I didn't mean to lose it. I mean, that we have been able to tell us that. This is our position.
So we have to do next session to discuss about this.
Yes, this is the beginning. This is the beginning.
Will there be a session?
It's just the basics.
We should have a session. We should have again to review these basics again. And then have something very simple. Now finally we go to the case. And it takes time.
So actually after this,
no, sure,
we
should have been the
focus.
Thank you very much. Beautiful and very substantial. Because we need substantial food here. We don't need to theorize immediately from the spot. We need something basic. And that was very important. And it initiates the right thing.
So we just need more of that stuff called time. To get it into the becoming of understanding, that's the problem. I think it's
you want
to have 2 hours, it's nothing for such a thing.
Would you like to end this sharing the quotation?
Can I do it now?
Yeah.
Okay. So let's this is again David Baum's thing. So
thank you. Bye.
So this is just I put picked these lines from Savitri just to refresh our mind. And really, it feels, because it's, you know, immediately makes you excited, as if we are pretty close to reality, we are just about to grab it. You know? And then it says, someone close to their bosoms, yet divine and far. Sure. A friend, and yet too great, only to know. She walked in the front towards a greater light. Their leader and queen opened their hearts and souls, one close to their bosoms, yet divine and far. Admiring and amazed, they saw her stride, attempting with a godlike rush and leap. Leap heights for their human stature too remote, or with a slow, great, many-sided toil, pushing towards aims they hardly could conceive, yet forced to be the satellites of her soul. They moved unable to forego her light. I feel the scientists are great seekers. They're satellites, aren't they? So, Shravindo, in a certain sense, matter is unreal and non-existent. That is to say, our present knowledge, idea, and experience of matter is not its truth. but merely a phenomenon of particular relation. See, again it's coming to that relation between our senses and the all existence in which we live. Matter is substance of the one conscious being, phenomenally divided, as you're saying, within itself, by the action of a universal mind. A division which the individual mind repeats, but which does not abrogate or at all diminish the unity of spirit or the unity of energy or the real unity of matter. Earth existence cannot be the result of the human mind, which is itself the result of our existence. Which is going against that matter is some kind of thought or is in our mind. Material substance is the form in which mind acting through sense contacts. Acting through sense contacts the conscious being, of which it is itself a movement. However brute and void of sense it seems to us, it is yet to the secret experience of the consciousness hidden within it, delight of being offering itself to this secret consciousness as object of sensation in order to tempt that hidden Godhead out of its secrecy. This is how I came with the secret within matter. Being manifest as substance, force of being cast into form, into a figured self-representation of the secret self-consciousness, delight offering itself to its own consciousness as an object. What is this but Satchidananda? Matter is Satchidananda, represented to his own mental experience as a formal basis of objective knowledge, action and delight of existence. There are quite certainly other states even of matter itself. There is undoubtedly an ascending series of the divine gradations of substance. There is the possibility of the material being transfiguring itself through the acceptation of a higher law than its own, which is yet its own because it is always there latent and potential in its own secrecy. This is somewhere it's really worth getting into this actuality and potentiality. We must judge of existence not by what we mentally conceive, but by what we see to exist. That's why the senses are given to us. We should not totally deny it. And the purest, freest form of insight into existence, as it is shown us, nothing but movement. Two things alone exist: movement in space, movement in time. The former objective, the latter subjective. Extension is real. Duration is real, space and time are real. Even if we can go behind extension in space and perceive it as a psychological phenomenon, as an attempt of the mind to make existence manageable by distributing the indivisible whole in a conceptual space, yet we cannot go behind that movement of succession and change in time. For that is the very stuff of our consciousness. This is actually a Buddhist thing. We are, and basically because it is really seeing the actuality as becoming. We are, and the world is a movement that continually progresses and increases by the inclusion of all the successions of the past and the present, which represents itself to us as the beginning of all the successions of the future. A beginning, a present that always eludes us because it is not. For it has perished before it is born. What is the eternal, indivisible succession of time carrying on its stream a progressive movement of consciousness, also indivisible. Duration then, eternally successive movement and changing time, is the sole absolute. Becoming is the only being. So, it is reducing reality as becoming. In reality, this opposition of actual insight into being to the conceptual fictions of the pure reason is fallacious. If indeed intuition in this matter were really opposed to intelligence, we could not confidently support a merely conceptual reasoning against fundamental insight. But this appeal to intuitive experience is incomplete. It is valid only so far as it proceeds, and it errs by stopping short of the integral experience. So long as the intuition fixes itself only upon that which we become, we see ourselves as a continual progression of movement and change in consciousness in the eternal succession of time. We are the river, the flame of Buddhist illustration. But there is a supreme experience and supreme intuition by which we go back behind our surface self and find that this becoming, change, succession are only a mode of our being. And there is that in us which is not involved at all in the becoming. Not only can we have the intuition of this, but is stable and eternal in us. Not only can we have the glimpse of it in experience behind the veil of continually fleeting becomings, but we can draw back into it and live in it entirely, so effecting an entire change in our external life and in our attitude and in our action upon the movement of the world. And this stability in which we can so live is precisely that which the pure reason has already given us, this being that you are talking about, that Einstein's, can be arrived at without reasoning at all, without knowing previously what it is. It is pure existence, eternal, infinite, indefinable, not affected by the succession of time, not involved in the extension of space, beyond form, quantity, quality, self only is absolute. This is the last. The pure existence is then a fact and no mere concept. It is the fundamental reality. But let us hasten to add, the movement, the energy, the becoming are also a fact, also a reality. The supreme intuition and its corresponding experience may correct the other, may go beyond, may suspend, but do not abolish it. We have therefore two fundamental facts of pure existence and of world existence, a fact of being, a fact of becoming. To deny one or the other is easy. To recognize the facts of consciousness and find out their relation is the true and fruitful wisdom. Stability and movement, we must remember, are only our psychological representations of the Absolute, even as our oneness and multitude. The Absolute is beyond stability and movement, as it is beyond unity and multiplicity. But it takes its eternal poise in the one and the stable and the stable, and whirls round itself infinitely, inconceivably, securely in the moving and multitudinous. World existence is the ecstatic dance of Shiva, which multiplies the body of the God numberlessly to the view. It leaves that white existence precisely where and what it was, ever is and ever will be. Its sole absolute joy, object is the joy of the dance.
Thank you.